So hi, Sue Hall and Tristan McDonald here again, inviting you to the fifth episode in our second series of Talking the Dis Out of Dyslexia, hosted by the Whole Dyslexic Society. This series is focusing in on the Davis learning strategies, which we've outlined in the first episode. And today, it is truly an honor to be talking to Abigail Marshall, who is the mother of a dyslexic and currently the webmaster for www.dyslexia.com. She's the most amazing go-to person for any questions, particularly on research. So Abigail, welcome, and please continue to introduce yourself.
Thank you for inviting me. I am a long since retired lawyer. I actually have not practiced law in 25 years because I quit my law career in order to work with Davis, because it was such a profound difference in my son's life to have the dyslexia program. I started referring other people to the program, and 25 years ago, there was no place to go for a Davis program except for Ron Davis's center in California. And when I kept referring other people, I kept getting these positive stories back again and again and again, the same experience I was having. So at first I thought, well, maybe it just works for kids like my son, because if you read The Gift of Dyslexia and how it describes a dyslexic kid, that could have been written by somebody writing about my son. So I thought, well, maybe just kids like him. But then I saw, well, it works for a lot of people. The thing that sold me on Davis was when I referred a good friend, and they turned her away. And they turned her away because the child was not motivated. It was one of the situations, the kid walks in and they say, you know, I think I'll be fine. I don't need any help. And that's not a problem. We're going to talk about Davis learning strategies, but that's a problem with that 1 week program, because nobody can work with a child who walked in on day one and like, I don't want to be here. To me, that told me they're being careful who they work with. They're not just trying to take people's money.
You wanted to make some sort of referral easy for other people.
The next step that happened was when I began to learn more, I realized that what Ron Davis was doing was unique worldwide. We're going to talk about Davis learning strategies. One backtrack, I do not work directly with students or clients. Mm-hmm. I have never actually been a Davis facilitator. I've completed all of the training courses so that I have my own understanding, but I've always been on the kind of communications end of things. My first job with Davis was as the editor of their quarterly news journal, The Dyslexic Reader. And then I moved on to managing the website, and then the websites grew and grew and grew, and I let someone else take over the newsletter. And a big part of my job over time with Davis has been also keeping up on the research and being able to answer people's questions and explore what research supports what we're doing, and also how it is distinct or different from various other approaches.
That's a really good point, Abigail, about it being distinct and different. So what would you say, as we are focusing on the strategies, what would you say to teachers who need to understand the distinct difference and who need to have the backup for the research? Because very few people change anything in the education system these days without research to back it up too, right?
Well, Davis Learning Strategies fills a gap. And I'm wondering if we can kind of come back to that research question, because I do want to preface, I don't have direct involvement, but I helped co-found Davis Dyslexia Association with Ron Davis. And back in the 90s, the other person I was working very closely with was Sharon Pfeiffer, who designed the Davis Learning Strategies program. And so even though I don't have direct experience, because I work with Sharon so long, I have a very good memory of working with her, chatting with her, because she had the idea of the program. Her background was, she had been a teacher for umpteen years. She was retired, and I believe she was also a reading specialist. She had come to work with Ron Davis and trained with him at his center before there was a formal association. And Sharon always loved working with the youngest children. The dyslexia program is generally 8 or over, but if there was a 7-year-old that won over her heart and had that level of motivation, she loved working with those younger kids. And it's important because Davis offers tools that children don't get with regular tutoring or teaching. And it didn't take long before Sharon got the idea, well, why are we waiting till these children are failing and they're 7 or 8 or 9 years old? And can't we give these tools to children at the beginning. What would happen if we give these tools to the children in kindergarten?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Why do we wait until they fail? And why do we keep giving them more of what they couldn't do?
Do you think it's possibly because they view that the child doesn't have a problem until a problem arises?
It's because the teachers in the education system don't understand the importance of teaching these tools. They assume that the child will already have this, because for someone who's not dyslexic, it seems simple. It doesn't seem like something that has to be taught. What Sharon did with her idea, the first thing she had to do was the Davis tools that were given to older children had to be modified because it was too complex to try to explain to a five-year-old. Mm-hmm. So just as a very simple example, one of the tools that comes with Davis is called an energy dial, which is a very simple approach to get a child to self-regulate their energy level and also to be able to observe the energy levels of those around them. I'm doing it right now, actually. I'm interrupting myself, but I'm telling myself to set my dial down to 4, because for me, if I'm doing a podcast, that will keep me from talking too fast. But we've always done that with dial settings 1 to 10. And the dial setting is very simple. It's just like a volume control, except we're setting our own personal energy level, with 10 being fleeing and running away from a tiger, and 1 being you're going to sleep. And so 4, 5, 6, there's that range of where it makes sense to interact with other people in a non-athletic setting. Mm-hmm. In Davis Learning Strategies, it's 1 through 9. Why? Because at kindergarten age, a lot of children haven't been introduced to the idea of 10 yet in terms of the numbers they work with. That was just a simple modification that fit within the curriculum she was dealing with, because what Sharon did was she went into the local schools where she worked in her community, and she recruited teachers from, I believe there were 3 classrooms in 2 local schools within the district. And the very nice thing was that the schools were large enough that they had enough classes, so that for every class that had a Davis Learning Strategies pilot, there was an equivalent class at the same school that didn't have it. So that created a nice built-in control group. The children in the beginning were randomly assigned to classes. There was no structure to that, but they stayed within the same classes, typically going through schools. So you had a school system that gave you your comparison group built in, with another classroom of kids who had the same socioeconomic status overall. And her plan was to develop a program that would go from K-3, kindergarten to third grade, follow it through, and introduce the Davis Learning Strategies on top of the regular curriculum, and then over time compare how the children did. Mm-hmm. And the actual study took 7 years to complete, because you had to have kids go from kindergarten, first grade, all through third grade, and then they had to evaluate what happened to the kids down the line. Because the goal is, are they going to successfully avoid children needing special education placements? Mm-hmm. And as far as I recall, I think there were absolutely 0 special education placements out of, I think there were 90 children, around 90 children in all. This is a reported research study and it has the numbers. But the most profound thing that happened was that there was a much higher level of gifted and talented placements post-Davis Learning Strategies.
Wow.
And to me, this was important for 2 reasons. One is that it's very easy to set up a research study and look at what you expect to happen. Mm-hmm. Whenever I look at a study and I see something unexpected happen, just for me personally, that strikes me as significant. It's like, mm-hmm. well, this wasn't planned. This was something that came out of it. So sometimes you can kind of tailor the results of the study to give you what you want. Mm-hmm. But you can't tailor it to give you what you don't expect. The other thing is, I remember way back when the study was ongoing, one of the things of Davis Learning Strategies is to model all the small words of language in Clay. Probably 95% overlap with the Dolch word list. These are the same sight words that are going to be taught to the children anyway, but these are going to be modeled in Clay. Mm-hmm. I remember early on when Sharon was just putting this project together, I had my son who was dyslexic and had done the Davis program. I also had a daughter who was not at all dyslexic. In fact, the opposite. She was an early reader. By the time she was four, she could read everything. So she was very bored when she got to kindergarten. So I said, well, what about a child like mine? Because the idea of Davis learning strategies is whole classroom. Every child in the classroom gets it. So won't this be boring for my child? Won't it keep my reading child behind? And Sharon told me, no, all the children are benefiting. And what she was seeing is that the children who were more advanced, who were not dyslexic, were getting a tremendous amount of enrichment from the dictionary skills aspects of the programs. She was walking around a classroom and hearing little kids discuss whether or not a word was an adjective and the reasons for the difference between spelling of homonyms or whatever. So we don't know, we'll never know whether the children who ended up in the gifted programs were also the ones who would have been dyslexic, or whether they were the ones who wouldn't have been and were able to take the program so much farther, or whether it was a combination. But what we do know is that this program is beneficial for everyone. And the other thing that's really important is that it doesn't require anything from the school other than to carve out some time for the program. It does not replace the regular curriculum. So if you're in a district and it's mandated that you use a curriculum with level readers, and then there are also a variety of phonics curriculums. So whatever the program has, the school can continue straight along using that program. The only thing is the time, and it doesn't take a lot of time. I think in Sharon's pilot, I think they were doing the Davis clay modeling sessions on alternate days. So there would be Tuesday, Thursday, you would have 45 minutes or an hour out of class time spent with doing the clay modeling. So when I say you have to have time, it's not a lot of time.
I think it's the time that you want it to be as well, because we've talked to Maggie Roberts in New Zealand, and she was saying that she gets all the children to do all the tools, and she models the tools. She obviously has them master their alphabet letters, uppercase and lowercase, and the reading exercises, and then she's starting to work on the trigger words. And so she makes a little bit of time for that every day. But she was telling us that in New Zealand, there are some schools who've just taken the tools and they're not necessarily doing all the alphabet mastery or the reading exercises. And some of them are just doing the tools and the mastery and so on. So a lot of the schools are taking little pieces of what the strategies consist of, and they've all had success. The schools where the teachers make it really part of their day, where they model everything and it becomes part of their routine, obviously they have more success overall. Yeah. But what Richard was saying in the last podcast was very interesting about those little trigger words, because he was saying that there are levels of understanding. And he quoted something called Bloom's taxonomy, which I'd never heard of. But this is a chart that shows you the levels of learning. And when a child is taught to memorize and rote learn, they reach one level of learning. And when a child is given all the meanings of these words, they reach another level of learning, which allows them to analyze and synthesize. And that takes them ahead into their senior school and their ability to manipulate thoughts. And when he was talking about that, I thought to myself, this is my education in a nutshell. I was the memorizing and the rote learning person who just got to that level and struggled when I got into senior school because I didn't have all the meanings that I needed. So when I listened to him, I heard that there was a whole new level of success that mastering those little trigger words brings about.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think ideally, if I was going to set up a school, then I would build it around Davis. Davis would be the first thing to do, and all the other curriculum would come in afterwards. But I made my comment about that it doesn't take a whole lot of time, because I also know so many teachers are in school systems where they have all these external requirements they are supposed to meet, and they are told what curriculum to use, and they were told what they're supposed to accomplish. And so you say to these teachers, well, I'm going to give you something else you have to do. It's like, oh, no way, I don't have time for any of this. But one of the things is introducing Davis learning strategies is just going to be a very big time saver in many ways. And before we talk about the clay, I talked a little bit about the dial setting. Davis has three tools that give the children the ability to self-regulate their focus of attention and their energy level and stress levels. The cool thing is these are good tools for grown-ups, parents, and teachers to use for themselves. I cannot imagine a better thing for teachers than the tool of release.
Yeah.
Children, even non-dyslexic children, do not come to school really quite ready for the demands that school imposes. And it has gotten worse here in the States in the past 20, 25 years since Sharon started, because they expect so much more of kindergartens now. My son struggled from first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, but at least when he was in kindergarten, he played.
Yeah.
And he was introduced to numbers and concepts, but he wasn't expected to read. These kids, they're not ready to start with. And I think also with our video app age, kids, when they're two, they're handed a smartphone to occupy themselves. And by the time they get to age five and they start in kindergarten, they're really adept at screens. So to come in and sit down at a desk in a classroom and listen to the teacher is boring as anything. And we know that even college-age students can't handle that part anymore, because what do college professors have to deal with these days is when they're giving a lecture, they look out and there are the students, you know, looking at their laptops and their phones. So this pull away from being able to focus attention on the task at hand is very, very strong these days. And in a kindergarten classroom or a first grade primary classroom, I think teachers know that it's pretty hard to get all those kids paying attention at once. The teacher is lucky if the teacher can manage to keep them all reasonably out of trouble. Because if there's one kid in the classroom who's acting up, that disrupts everything. And the Davis tools provide the kids early on with these tools that they can focus their attention, they can calm down. Release is simply to use a sigh as a way of relaxing and letting go. When the teacher says, everybody do a release, class gets calmer. The focusing exercise is very powerful, because what Davis discovered, which is important, is not only is there a state of mind of kind of relaxed focus where your attention is directed where it should be, but that also affects perceptions. What Davis discovered and what we know is when the child is not focused, they are also much more likely to be seeing reversed letters or letters out of sequence, not hearing things properly. You know that if your own mind is wandering, you might not hear what someone says to you. This probably happens in everybody's home all the time. Well, it wasn't that the person wasn't listening. Their attention was elsewhere and they really didn't hear. And in a classroom, if you've got 25 children in the classroom, you've got 25 little minds all over the place. And because their minds are all over the place, half of them aren't going to even hear what the teacher has just said or register it. Being able to use a tool as simple as focus gets those kids what teachers call on task, so that they are all able to actually hear what the teacher has just instructed them to do, because they were reminded to do a release and a focus right before the teacher got to the part where she was giving instructions. And we've already talked about the dial setting.
So what you're saying, Abigail, is that those tools, once the teacher has delivered them to all the children in the class, basically makes the teacher's life so much easier.
Completely easier. The teacher has classroom management tools. I mean, I know over the years when I would read feedback from teachers who were attending Davis Learning Strategies workshops, the teachers were always excited about those as a classroom management tool, because it's so much more effective to have everyone check their focus and check their energy level with the dial than it is to yell at kids.
Yeah.
I mean, teachers have already been trying. Listen up, everybody. But listen up doesn't work if the person doesn't have the inner skill. All right, class, pay attention. Pay attention doesn't work if the child doesn't know how to pay attention yet.
I'm like a broken record on these podcasts, because I usually say, well, everybody says pay attention. Everybody says concentrate. Nobody ever tells them how, right? Nobody. And to have an exercise that you actually taught to be able to focus is magical.
It's so simple. Then once the teacher has it, there's a natural tendency to resist, and especially if the child feels they are being chastised in some way, or if they feel that they are being limited from having fun in some way.
Yeah.
And the Davis tools are gentle and positive. Certainly no child ever has to be singled out. Let's all do a big release class doesn't sound like the teacher is now demanding that they give up the thing that they were all having so much fun with.
With the DLS method, the teachers can trust that the students are using their tools to focus.
Yes, it takes a reminder, and sometimes teachers will work out their own signals. There's a DLS video, an older video that was done in the classroom where all the children, when they were doing their focusing, would cross their arms in front of their chest. And people ask about that. Is that a Davis tool? That's not a Davis tool. That is a signal the teachers in that classroom came up with because it's handy to have a signal that everyone recognizes. Davis also provides the tools for reading that are being left out of any other standard curriculum.
Abigail, I'm going to try and jump ahead a little bit here because after the tools, then obviously the children master their alphabet letters and they have accurate perception of those letters. And then they're taken into the reading exercises when we focus on spell reading as opposed to the usual phonetic instruction. And I happen to know that you are the master of knowing all the research around phonics and whole word. And maybe you could explain to the teachers whose usual question is, but if you don't use phonics, how do the children decode words? How do they grow their vocabulary? I know that you know the whole story on this one.
Okay, I will explain that. But first of all, I want to say with Davis Learning Strategies, we are not telling the schools that they have to drop the phonics program. If they have a phonics curriculum, it can be used right alongside the phonics curriculum because it's not a program for dyslexia. Mm-hmm. So maybe this school has 20% dyslexic children. Maybe one out of five children is dyslexic, but then the other four out of five are not. And probably at least three out of five of those children will find learning phonics very easy and a good way to go. You would create just as many problems if you had a classroom that only taught to a dyslexic learning style.
True.
Because it would make it more difficult for the children who pick up with phonics very quickly. But I just wrote a blog post that was published last night about orthographic mapping and dyslexia. Orthographic mapping is a term that means what leads a person to have a memory of a word etched so strongly in their mind that they automatically recognize that word in print without conscious effort. And that happens all the time. You're driving along, you see a stop sign, you don't try to decode stop, you know, it registers in your brain immediately. And there's a myth about dyslexia that dyslexics can't get it, but they need to get to there. They need the extra tools. Unfortunately, a lot of people who use the term think it's just a matter of phonetic decoding and that after having decoded a word once or twice, then the child will have it mapped in their mind and have it forever. And that doesn't happen for several reasons. The blog post I wrote talked about the visual piece and the meaning piece for each word. Every word has three parts, what it looks like, what it sounds like, and what it means. The vision piece, and this is where our reading exercises come in, the spell reading, sweep, sweep, spell. Not all children naturally take in the letters from left to right as they read. That's a learned skill. Some children, before they've come to school in their preschools or from their parents reading to them and pointing out the sequence of letters, might have started to pick it up. Some kids might start kindergarten with no ideas. They may be looking at that word, and even though the letters are left to right, they have not been trained visually to sequence those letters from left to right. And so when we do the spell reading, it is simply reinforcing the sequence. And we do not do phonics during that time. It doesn't mean we never do phonics. We think of it as an exercise. Before COVID, I used to go to the gym and I would do strength training at the gym. If I'm doing a isolated exercise for part of my body, I'm doing bicep curls. Well, that doesn't mean that I can't do other exercises or other things with my arms at other times. It's just when I'm doing the bicep curls with the weights, I'm trying to build up a particular muscle in my arm. And that's what we're trying to do with the spell reading is we're very gently building up that visual sequencing skill of looking at the letters in order. So take a very common error that people make, confusing from with form. Same letters, four-letter words, it's very easy to mistake from and form. Mm-hmm. If you come to it as part of the reading exercise, you're going to say F-O-R-M and then say the word form. That is reinforcing the sequence, and it also, of course, lets the teacher see right away when the kid is not perceiving the sequence. Teachers will very often tell the child to sound out the word, not realizing that that child is not even consistently seeing the letters in the same order.
You have to have that consistency before you can help the child.
That is something that has to be learned how to be done automatically too, okay? That is something that has to be built into the brain. So you do an exercise for it until it's automatic. So every time a person looks at a word, they automatically scan the letters in order, in sequence, left to right. But there's actually research that shows with dyslexics that there can be significant improvement with as little as 10 minutes of visual training. I mean, there was a study that came out very recently where they just get 10 minutes of a training session before or after testing and saw a difference. Now, that study didn't show how long that lasted. I would think that if you did 10 minutes one day and never did it again, it would be just like my doing those bicep curls one day and never again. But it shows that the practice, what we do with Davis reading exercise, we only do those exercises for 5 or 10 minutes each time. We don't have to spend an hour practicing that. It's just a quick little exercise. And if the child is being taught phonics, then it's very easy to say, while we're doing this exercise, we're not doing the phonics, we're not sounding out now. This is just an exercise for your brain. I think children should be given all the strategies, all of our strategies, the Davis strategies, and all the other strategies, and helped to know whatever works best for them. Because the truth is, in English, phonics doesn't always work. We have all of these irregular words. So even for a person who's very good at phonetic decoding, they're going to find words that just don't meet the rules. But at the same time, reading can be fun and easy for every child. And I think what hurts children is when they only have a strategy that's not working for them or is confusing to them. And then, in a sense, they develop a fear of reading early on. And I call it a fear because the minute they are told to read, they kind of clam up and freeze up. And that in itself creates a cascade of other problems. And the whole idea of Davis learning strategies was give them these tools before that reaction kicks in.
Sense.
Yeah. Okay. And then the other part, of course, is the meaning part. I'm going to take another aside right now. I'm in my 60s, and a few years ago, I decided to exercise my brain. I was going to study foreign languages on Duolingo. And I'm a kind of a Duolingo addict. I've studied, I think, 7 different languages now. Because of all of my history, I've also observed myself learning a new language. But one of the things I can observe with myself, I don't start recognizing words until I have the vocabulary. If I don't know what the word means, in some languages, in Italian or Spanish, I can easily sound the word out. But when I kind of throw that out a little bit and start with a new alphabet, before I try Cyrillic, I tried Polish, which uses a Roman alphabet, but in letter combinations you would never imagine.
Wow.
So before I could pronounce the words, I needed to know what they mean to recognize them. And I can recognize in print words I don't know how to pronounce because there's a lot of foreign language words that I lost the ability to make those sounds with my mouth. So my accent would be absolutely terrible. I mean, I love French. I absolutely adore studying French. My French pronunciation would be the most embarrassing thing in the world. I just can't make the sounds properly. I don't know if I hear it in my head properly, but I recognize the words because I've got a really great vocabulary. And French is very logical. I love French because it's a very, very logical language. But knowing what the words mean is so important to anchoring them in my memory and then remembering how to spell them. That's where the play modeling comes in for all of those little words. It gives the child a meaning. Because those words are abstract and they don't have a picture attached to them, in a lot of people's minds, children, but also I think in adults, the words are kind of filler without meaning. A child really might not understand what the is other than as something that kind of goes along with the word. Because in German, they say, just memorize it. Just memorize it all together and you'll get it. Well, memorizing is a harder way to go for anything if you don't have something else you can attach it to.
Yeah, and the definition of to learn by rote is to learn without thinking or understanding. Well, who would want to do that anyway? What's the point?
It won't stick in your brain that way. What brain science tells us is a good part of what the brain does is forget, okay? If we try to remember everything, our brains would be crowded with trivial details. What did I eat for lunch 4 weeks ago? So what happens is we live through our days, and then every night we go to sleep. And when we go to sleep, our brain consolidates what is important and discards what wasn't. That's actually a normal process of sleep, is to keep what was important and kind of do some house cleaning and throw away the rest. So that's why if you spend all day long playing Tetris, you go to sleep and you dream of Tetris because you spent so many hours doing your Tetris that the brain thinks that must be important. That's not a good thing for your brain, but that's how you've conditioned yourself. But when you have rote memorization without context, the brain doesn't have any other hook. Whereas if you learn something, one of the really powerful parts of the word mastery process of modeling it in clay is just that it takes extra time and it's engaging. It requires the child to participate and engage their creative brain in thinking about it. And that becomes something that the brain is going to keep at the end of the day instead of tossing off with all of the other irrelevant stuff that came into that person's life. No system is perfect. It's very possible to model a word and not remember it, but it's a lot harder to forget the model you made of the word any than it is to forget the list of words you were asked to memorize.
Right.
This is so interesting because as a facilitator, I'm learning so much more depth to what we do. The wheels are just turning now, and I'm realizing that what you're saying, the length of time that it takes to make a model and to make the word, is directly relevant to the ability for us to remember it. Because as you say, when we take a little while to do something, then the brain thinks it's more important. And that's a really cool argument for word mastery, because I mean, there are people who might say, oh, but it's going to take too long to model these words, it's just too long a process. But in actual fact, it is the length of the process and the fact that we're giving ourselves all those three parts that's going to make it important.
It's almost like building a relationship with the word.
According to Glasser, we remember 90% of what we do.
Exactly.
Right?
It's something like that. I'm 66 and I don't remember 90%. Well, one thing I learned for myself, when I was in the university, I was in a university with a quarter system. So we would have classes for 10 weeks and then we would do new classes, and we would take usually about 4 or 5 classes each quarter. And every quarter I would take one class just for fun. I would have these other classes taking chemistry or whatever was a difficult course to take. But then I would also take a film class or an art class or something that would be fun. Uh-huh. After I was no longer in school, I can remember in great detail what happened in all of my 4 fun classes. The only thing I remember of all of the chemistry classes was sitting in the back of a lecture hall and the professor being very boring, but I cannot remember a thing that I learned in chemistry.
That's really saying something.
And a smaller class, but the ones where there was more engagement and give and take. Then I remember years later of what other students said or what the professor said. And I know when I went to law school, which is very hard and very intense, law school was built around the Socratic method, which does require that level of engagement and participation. So I think that the more the person participates, the more the connections are made in the brain that make the whole experience memorable over time. Right. And it does seem like a lot of time to be spent learning one word.
The good thing about the strategy is when you take a workshop as a teacher, it comes with this wonderful manual, and the manual tells you week by week what to do. And I have a suspicion that if they can get all their alphabet letters mastered by the end of kindergarten, that's a huge success. So I'm not even sure if they start the reading.
I think they do go on to words. I know that the manual also has other suggested classroom activities. So it's building on that. It's other things you can do. And I remember when my son was in kindergarten, this was before his teacher was proud of having an old-fashioned kindergarten. They would spend one whole week on each letter, and they would do all kinds of activities around each letter. They would do artwork around the letter. It would be different things every week. If this was the week you were going to spend on letter G, you did all kinds of things around letter G. There would be G words and G activities or whatever. And yeah, I think it was pretty certain that by the end of the week, you understood the letter G. Now, my dyslexic son never quite learned which direction the letter J faced in all of that time. But the point is that spending extra time with something with the very younger children is time well spent. Mm-hmm. It makes it more memorable. It sticks in their mind more.
So, Abigail, how are we going to tie this all up together? What are we going to say to teachers? We can present the DLS to them. There's plenty of research behind it. It's going to make their lives easier. What would you add to that?
Okay. Well, first of the research, I would like to say that Sharon Pfeiffer's pilot study was published in a research journal. We have links to the website, davislearn.com. There was a more recent study, not a formal study, but in New Zealand, it was implemented over several years in 10 different schools. And there's an evaluation of how each school implemented it. And that is the one where they found that even with partial implementation, they saw great improvement, but with full implementation, they saw even better, so they could be connected to the level of improvement. And we even had something, this is a sad thing to have happened, but kind of historical, and it's not published, but it shows us how strong these methods are. There was a rural school in Colorado that was the lowest performing in its area. And they implemented Davis learning strategies. They were named as a model school because it was throughout the school. And their reading scores went to the top of the state. They were featured in the news because they had improved things so radically. Now, the sad part is that as things happen, the teachers that were there retired and moved on. Those students grew up. They went off to high school. A new principal came in, new teachers, and Davis Learning Strategies was dropped from that curriculum. So if I look that school up now, where are they? Right back rock bottom. It's not a scientific research study about that. We don't know what other factors come into play. Maybe the demographics of the area changed. I don't know. But I do know that we have seen a situation where there's improvement when this program is there, and then it's lost when it's not there anymore. And the other thing that's really nice about Davis Learning Strategies is it is so easy and overall inexpensive to implement. It's a two-day workshop for teachers to attend. Buying some clay, many schools already have the clay on hand. There's dictionaries. Many schools have dictionaries already. There are koosh balls. These are not expensive materials. They're reusable. It's not like you have to get a bunch of new workbooks every single year. You're not going to have to invest in fancy software or long-term licensing fees with a software company.
Yeah, it's inexpensive and effective, no matter how you look at it.
Right. So for a teacher who feels comfortable, because no system is going to work if it's imposed from on high. All the teachers know this. You know, there's a new curriculum comes in and the teachers don't like it and the teachers don't want to do it. And how's it going to get done? Well, you have to have teachers who want to do this too. I think if they can see what it does, I think teachers will find that it's much more fun and effective than a lot of other things. Certainly better results than just having kids do a bunch of worksheets. And one place where it has scaled up very nicely, there is a very large school in India which implemented Davis Learning Strategies, where they have worked with hundreds of students and they have trained all of the teachers. And so this is called the Omega School in Chennai, and they've been doing this for years, and they have. And when everyone understands what the program is and have the language, when I say the language, if you know the Davis words, focus, release, dial setting, very simple things, then that is useful for that seventh grade teacher at that school, if it is a school that carries the same children from K to 8, or if it's a private school that has kindergarten through 12th grade. Then it can be used at any level because it becomes part of the internalized shared vocabulary that everyone knows. And it's just so easy.
The passion that I have around getting these methods into school from K to 3 is because I am so tired of children arriving on my doorstep saying they're stupid. There's absolutely no reason for these children to seemingly fail. They're perfectly capable of learning. They just don't happen to learn in a method that works for them. And so these methods can save time for the teacher. They can make the teacher's life easier. They can save money in the schools because maybe they don't have to have so many SEAs, or do you call them in the States, educational assistants in the classrooms. Those people can then focus on the children who really need one-on-one help. There's a saving all the way around. There's a saving of energy. There's a saving of frustration and heartbreak. And I feel that if a school really understood that they have the ability or the opportunity to use methods that will reach every child, regardless of their learning style, I'm sure they would be clamoring for it.
That's why I kind of come back to how important that focus tool is, because I think at that K-1 level, especially for the children who have real difficulty sustaining their attention, we talked about the idea of 90% of what you do is remembered. Well, I think for some kids, certainly like my son, I think 90% of what happened in the classroom never registered with him. His mind was somewhere else when the teacher was talking and he didn't understand it, or his mind went somewhere else because the third word in the sentence he didn't understand. And if a child is behaving, the teacher has no way of knowing where their brain is, whether that child is actually taking in the information, and the child can't learn what they can't take in. So if you can just have a tool that simply gets more children attending to what's going on, it's not 100%. You could not reasonably expect a kindergartner to sit like a university student and listen to a teacher lecture for 25 minutes, but you can at least get all the children together at the same time, focused at the point in time when the teacher is giving instructions for each new activity or giving a lesson in something.
I was kind of curious about your role in brain research.
Well, I've just been fascinated about reading brain research. I'm not a brain researcher, and I don't understand a lot of the words in the studies I read, but I love reading the study, and I have learned a lot. I will go and I will read an original study as well as reading a book by someone who writes about the study, because sometimes what they write about doesn't give you all the details. Sometimes I'll write to researchers to ask some questions about their studies too, and they're always very, very happy to hear. I think university brain researchers don't get a lot of people interested in their work. No. So if somebody actually writes them and says, oh, I was reading your study and I didn't understand this, they are so happy to have someone who actually read it. No, the thing is, there's plenty of research. I think what people don't understand about the research is they think that there's a simple research study you could go and it gives you an answer. And it's not like that. It's like a jigsaw puzzle with a million pieces. And it's one of those jigsaw puzzles where you can flip over the pieces and make another puzzle. So it's colored on both sides. And you've got lots and lots of studies and each one is a piece, but very few of them seem to connect. And then you have some that don't fit properly because they seem like they studied the same thing. They came to different conclusions. And the brain is very, very, very complex. And research is only in its infancy. And it's going to be a very long time before we have a consensus of very strong evidence anywhere as to what's going on in the brain. People don't understand the study of a dyslexic brain, and it'll show, well, the dyslexic students were doing this and the non-dyslexic were doing this with their brain. But the problem is the brain scan was only doing a discrete task. So for example, the subjects might be asked to indicate whether two words rhyme or not. Well, that's part of understanding reading, but that's only a tiny part. Do you use your same part of your brain to judge whether two words are rhyming as you do to make sense of the words, or to know whether they begin with the same letter or end with the same letter, or who knows? We have to have a lot more research before we get there.
Yeah.
But some of the things that I've said, the importance of attention focus, it's kind of obvious, but there's also, you know, there's certainly studies that show that paying attention is a learned skill. And if you go broader than dyslexia, if you want to look at what I said about all of that screen time, you'll find plenty of studies, but you can observe it in your own home, in yourself. seriously. You know, I mean, I used to be such an avid reader, and I still love reading, but I find after all of the years on the internet, I'm so used to Facebook memes, it's very hard for me to get the concentration if I'm watching a video. The TED Talks are short enough. I'm going to come watch an hour-long video. Well, I don't have an hour. I'll turn up the speeds of the video.
The whole reason that we have this word dyslexia is because the early brain scans showed that people who were good readers processed auditorily and people who were poor readers processed visually. And therefore, if our brains aren't working the way they should in processing auditorily, we must have something wrong with us.
Dyslexia predates that. It goes back to the early 20th century. And basically, it was by the mid-60s, it was a diagnosis of exclusion. If a child has unexpected difficulty learning to read, and it can't be explained by other factors, they don't have a vision problem. It's not sociocultural. It's not lack of opportunity. They've been in a school. They've been given the proper education. Then they started calling it dyslexia. And a lot of the focus early on was on the visual problems, but dyslexia got caught up later on in what we call the reading wars, which was a backlash against whole language. And I was taught by what was called the look-say method, the readers. I can still remember. See, some things you remember your whole life. I remember the words in my first grade primer, you know, tip, tip, come tip, come. And it was repetitive words and highly predictable text. So it's a whole word method. That was replaced in the 60s. That was thought to be boring and not relevant. And it gave rise to the whole language movement. And the whole language movement caused a backlash with the phonics movement. And somewhere along the line, the experts started to say, well, you need a little bit of both, and they created something called balanced literacy. So now the reading wars are between balanced literacy and systematic phonics. And the phonics people will see dyslexia as a phonics problem. Dyslexia is only a phonics problem in English. All the other languages, all the transparent languages, the children pick up the phonics fine, and dyslexia is a fluency problem. And so I don't think dyslexia ever was a phonics problem. I think the English language has a phonics problem. And I don't see how anybody thinks you can teach phonics in isolation to master English. You always have to have meaning in English, because English doesn't make sense without meaning. All of the English spellings are determined with a reference to meaning. But what you see a lot in research is people pick and choose their research. And they pick and choose their favorite experts. So that's why phonics people will say, well, all the research shows this. Well, it doesn't all show that. It's very weak, actually, but they have their favorite research and they glom onto it. But most brain research and most educational research is with very small groups, because the brain research is just cost prohibitive to try to do a study and do brain scans on 100 people. So they do brain scans on 10 people or 6 people. And those numbers aren't large enough to really draw statistically valid conclusions. And the same with education. It's very hard. So even our own studies, we can implement Davis learning strategies in one school and see what happens. That tells us we know it can work. But it doesn't say that you could take Davis learning strategies and implement it in every school everywhere and it would always work. Now, I don't think the problem is with the method. I think the problem is with other factors. You need a change in the attitude of schools before you could implement a method like Davis learning strategies, which is built upon notions of individual autonomy, and that it's okay to have children doing different creative things at every table. And I think for America, for Canada, that notion is very common in our school system. We expect children to go to school and have fun and have recess and have art class. And so I don't think it's a problem at all for our schools. I think it fits in very nicely.
Miguel, I'm going to stop you now on the grounds that you might need another cup of tea. I'm just going to finish this off by saying a huge thank you to you, because you are always a wealth of knowledge. You are amazing. I don't know how you keep all that information in your head. And I know that facilitators all the way around the world are so grateful to you for always being there to always be able to answer their questions, because you do know what you're talking about. And I'm very, very grateful to have you on this podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Wow. I feel so much better about forgetting things now. When my memory is called into question, I usually say to people, I'm getting on in years now, so there's absolutely nothing wrong with my memory. It's just full. But now I know that I've been discarding what I didn't need and only keeping what I did need. And I also know that I really have to cut down on my binge watching now, because now I know there's a part of my brain that thinks the programs I watch are really important and it's going to hang on to them. So the thing that I love about this is everything that Abigail has said substantiates every part of the Davis Learning Strategies. And I think one of the most important messages that I'm hearing is, now that we have to do so much online, these strategies where you're actually making something and doing something and participating in an action that does take longer than normal is such a wonderful idea, because rather than just writing out a spelling word a few times or saying it a few times, if you're taking maybe 20 or 30 minutes to make a model and to make the word and to master that word, again, you're giving your brain that message that it's important and it will hang on to that information. And the fact that we use clay and it's such a hands-on process is a wonderful antidote to all this time that we have to spend online. So thank you, Abigail. Always a dream. So grateful to you. The next podcast will be Chelsea Flett, who is using these methods. And Chelsea's really had to cope with COVID. So this particular episode will give you an introduction into how she's managed to use these methods in school, in small groups, online with parents, and getting back into another difficult situation this month. So thank you for listening. And one more to go. Take care.